Today is July 13th, 2026. This is your geopolitics briefing for Macro Observer. In the next 8 to 10 minutes, we'll cover the Kiel Institute's new findings on Russia's collapsing war chest, NATO's Ankara summit and its $160 billion Ukraine pledge, and Iran's strategy of converting battlefield losses into leverage over the Strait of Hormuz. Start with the number that matters most, 1.8%. That's what's left in Russia's national wealth fund as a share of GDP, down from 6.5% when the war began in 2022. The Kiel Institute's new Endgame report, authored by Torbjorn Becker, Moritz Schulerich, and Matthew C. Klein, calls this structural exhaustion, and the phrase is not rhetorical flourish. Oil and gas revenues collapsed 45% year-on-year in the first quarter of 2026 and 38% over the first 4 months of the year. Ukrainian drone strikes reportedly took up to 40% of Russia's export refining capacity offline at points in March. The strategic calculus here is that Moscow is burning through its reserve cushion at a rate that turns a war of attrition into a race against its own balance sheet. The budget numbers reinforce that. The first quarter deficit hit 4.6 trillion rubles, or roughly $59.5 billion, already exceeding the entire year's target of 3.8 trillion rubles. Corporate debt has surged by 34 trillion rubles, something like $438 billion since the invasion began. Separately, United 24 Media reports $13 billion in Russian bank cash withdrawals through June 8th, a 30-year high, alongside a Kremlin-proposed windfall tax of up to 20% on last year's so-called excess profits. Building on that, 75% of Russian businesses reported revenue or profit declines in 2025. More importantly, this exhaustion has a geopolitical price tag. Russia's trade dependence on China has climbed to 35%, and Beijing is reportedly extracting a 40% discount on Russian gas relative to other buyers, an arrangement the Kiel report frames as inverting the traditional Sino-Russian hierarchy. And yet, Russia still pulled in an estimated $160 billion from oil exports and $39 billion from gas in 2025, which tells you the suppression is real but incomplete. European intelligence sources, cited by the FAZ, independently described the banking sector as under unsustainable strain, accusing the Kremlin of propping up balance sheets through preferential defense sector lending. There's also a data problem worth flagging. Russia claims 6% inflation while its central bank holds rates near 16%, a divergence the report's authors say simply doesn't add up. The historical echo here is Soviet-era command economics, where defense spending crowds out everything else. And there's a wild card, an exogenous oil shock, like the temporary spike above $100 a barrel during the Iran-Hormuz crisis before it settled back near $50 after a U.S.-Iran agreement, could hand the Kremlin windfall relief without requiring any policy change at all. That's the pattern sanctioned states like Iran and Venezuela have exploited before. While Russia's fiscal runway shortens, the Western commitment to Ukraine just got a lot more concrete. NATO's Ankara summit, held around July 7th and 8th, produced three moves that together institutionalized long-term backing. European members and Canada committed roughly $80 billion in military support for 2026, with a comparable pledge for 2027, about $160 billion across 2 years, notably excluding direct U.S. financial contribution. Kyiv Post reporting ties that figure to the EU's existing $103 billion loan facility for 2026 through 2027, rather than treating it as entirely new money. Context matters here. The BBC reported Ukraine's 2026 budget of $112 billion, 60% of it earmarked for the war effort, left a $45 billion gap, and Bloomberg had warned Kyiv could run out of funds by the end of June. Second, and maybe more consequential long-term, President Trump announced the U.S. would license Ukraine to manufacture Patriot interceptors domestically, with production potentially starting within 2 to 3 months. Third, NATO designated Ukraine a security contributor to the Euro-Atlantic area, language typically reserved for prospective membership candidates. The strategic calculus here is that this Patriot license extends a privilege previously granted only to Germany and Japan, and it's responding to a genuine emergency. During a Russian strike on July 6th, Ukraine failed to intercept a single one of 23 Iskander-M missiles fired at it. Ukraine's Iskander interception rate has fallen from around 80% at the start of the year to below 40% by mid-May. Ukraine's projected 2026 defense production capacity, $55 billion, is now 55 times pre-invasion levels, which is the kind of industrial base that makes a Patriot license plausible rather than symbolic. Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova called the Ankara outcomes catastrophic and irresponsible, and analysts read that as genuine alarm rather than posturing. Czech President Petr Pavel has warned of a narrowing 60-day negotiation window tied to Russia's September 20th parliamentary elections, arguing Putin is unlikely to announce general mobilization before the vote, but could do so immediately after. And there's a sharper warning underneath that. The U.S. has reportedly cautioned Warsaw that Russia may consider an armed provocation against Poland within months, testing Article 5 resolve. Now to the Middle East, where Dr. Stanley Johnny of The Hindu, speaking on Strat News Global's The Gist, offers a sobering read on how Iran has managed its post-ceasefire position. Iran struck Kuwait, Bahrain, and Qatar in two waves last Thursday. The first strike on Qatar since the June 2025 ceasefire memorandum and claims to have damaged a U.S. airbase in Jordan. More importantly, Johnny argues Iran has successfully tied the United States to the Hormuz question, a problem that simply didn't exist before this escalation, effectively deferring the conversation everyone actually wanted to have, Iran's nuclear program. The shifting geography of power inside Tehran is worth noting, too. The Supreme National Security Council is now headed by an IRGC general. The parliament speaker is a former IRGC Air Force commander, and President Pezeshkian has been sidelined to managing the wartime economy with no visible role in major decisions. Johnny predicts any eventual settlement looks like JCPOA 2.0. Iran downblending its roughly 400-kilogram stockpile of 60% enriched uranium under IAEA monitoring while keeping enrichment capability as leverage. Iran's real priorities are the roughly $24 billion in frozen funds, with Qatar reportedly pledging to release about $6 billion and the UAE about $3 billion, and continued control over Hormuz shipping. On a separate U.S. talk show panel, Trump was shown threatening Iran's electric grid and desalinization plants while confirming a strike on Karg Island, Iran's primary oil export terminal, while explicitly ordering forces not to target oil infrastructure directly. That's a calibrated threat, preserving off-ramps while maximizing credibility. Building on that, Johnny notes Hezbollah, cut off from Iranian resupply, is now in a standoff with Israel over disarmament that's inflaming Lebanon's Shia population, pushing conditions towards something resembling the 1975 to 1990 Civil War era. And in Syria, Macron's Damascus visit, chasing reconstruction contracts and strategic depth on Israel's northern front, unfolded amid two explosions attributed to resurgent ISIS cells, a reminder that the post-Assad order remains genuinely fragile. Johnny frames this French outreach as an attempt to reverse a decades-long exclusion from the Levant, dating back to the 1956 Suez Crisis. One more thread worth watching. Ukraine's defense industrial base itself has become a strategic asset. Tim Mack of Counteroffensive, on CIS's Russian Roulette podcast, describes a sector that's gone from a handful of state-owned firms before 2022 to a decentralized ecosystem of over 430 tracked private companies, possibly more than 1,000 total. Layered defense combining cheap interceptor drones and machine gun-equipped pickup trucks is achieving roughly a 90% shoot-down rate against Shahed-style drones. Though Mack is clear that Ukraine cannot realistically build its own Patriot-class ballistic missile defense, which is exactly why the Ankara licensing decision matters so much. So where does this leave things heading into the next 48 hours? The signal to watch is Poland's eastern border. U.S. officials have warned Warsaw that Russia may test Article 5 resolve with a small, deniable incursion framed as a navigational error, building on the pattern of drone probing already observed in Polish airspace. RUSI's Neil Barnett assesses the scenario as plausible in form, but strategically unfavorable for Moscow, given uncertain payoff and the likelihood that at least some NATO members respond regardless. Watch for any unusual air defense activity or diplomatic signaling out of Warsaw and Brussels in that window. It would be the clearest early indicator of whether Russia's fiscal desperation is translating into horizontal escalation rather than negotiation. Stay vigilant until tomorrow. That's your core brief for today. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with more.